Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 12th of February, these are our main stories. The UN humanitarian chief says the Turkey-Syria earthquake is the worst natural disaster in the region in a century, as the WHO warns that nearly 26 million people have been affected. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said a US military fighter jet acting on his orders has shot down a high-altitude airborne object over the northwestern Yukon territory. And a rare glimpse into what's going on inside Iran on the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Also in this podcast, a crowd break their way into a police station in Pakistan to kill a man accused of blasphemy. And the curator who needs your help to track down this.
David Bowie famously wore a Mr. Fish dress on the cover of his album, The Man Who Sold the World. We don't know where that dress is, so that is the dream piece that we would love to know where it is.
Almost a week after earthquakes struck southern Turkey and northern Syria, the United Nations humanitarian chief Martin Griffiths has described them as the region's worst natural disaster in a century. The number of people confirmed dead in both countries has risen to more than 25,000, and the World Health Organization has warned that nearly 26 million people have been affected. Mr. Griffiths is visiting the Turkish province of Kahramanmaraş. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, spoke to him while they were walking through the rubble.
I think it's the worst natural disaster that I've ever seen. It's also the most extraordinary international response, as you know. We have more than 100 countries who've sent people here. So there's been an incredible response.
And what is so amazing is that people are still coming out of the rubble alive 6 days in.
It's shocking. It's also, in a perverse sense, quite heartening.
The fact that people with great expertise who got here very quickly, committed, working day and night to do what's needed, that's remarkable. And I hope that when we launch our appeals for both Turkey and Syria the next day or so, that we'll get the generous donor response as well.
What do they need the most now?
To come to a conclusion as to when they call off the rescue efforts, which is a really difficult question because of who's left behind. Really worried about medical next, particularly in northwest Syria where we have cholera already. There's a huge need for urgent medical care, mobile clinics, field hospitals. I think the United Kingdom is sending in a field hospital. And then the period of humanitarian aid, the next 3 months, for which we're appealing, which will cover shelter, livelihoods, food, nutrition and healthcare. The tragedy about Syria, that it was bad enough in the northwest, as you know.
In the last rebel-held area,
before all this, and then all this came. I don't think it's right to give up hope that we will get access. We are looking very actively and firmly and hard for opening up 2 more crossing points for Turkey into the northwest in the coming days. We're going to put a resolution for the Security Council. If anybody wants to veto it, let them do so. The case for those 2 additional crossing points is a black and white humanitarian case. This is not politics. And people who say that we're playing with politics, that's not fair.
How optimistic are you that you're going to be able to get aids to all parts of Syria, that the government in Damascus will be ready to help?
The indications as of today are positive. As you know, yesterday the Syrian government issued a decree allowing aid to go in without let or hindrance. What Syria faces is a lot of governments who don't want to give aid through Syria, which I think is inappropriate in this context.
Because of their opposition to President Bashar al-Assad.
Yes, exactly, and all the terrible consequences of this awful war.
What's your greatest fear now?
Greatest fear now is when that awful day comes when we learn how many people really died.
Martin Griffiths speaking to Lise Doucette. Emergency teams in Turkey are still finding a few people alive in the rubble, as our Europe correspondent Nick Beek reports.
Minor miracles are still happening, even after all this time. A 5-year-old girl rescued in the city of Maraş. In Hatay, 7-year-old Ishra freed. After 136 hours under the rubble. A woman, 5 months pregnant, found alive in Gaziantep, although there's no word on how she and her unborn child are doing. No such joy elsewhere in Gaziantep. Instead, the pain of losing a cousin when the earthquake struck. Survivors are desperate for whatever they can find. The Ali Archelebi Mosque in Gaziantep has become a refuge for some of those who have nothing and need shelter in any form.
Well, this is just one of many makeshift communities that have sprung up across the city. Here it's a mixture of Turks and Syrian refugees who are displaced and homeless once again. And all of them are preparing to spend a sixth night out in the cold.
Halil Ali is from the Syrian city of Aleppo.
The problem is the cold. We have children, we have babies. It's a struggle. But Turkey is helping us.
But that's not how Turkish mother of three Sedef sees it.
We got help from some people. They were generous and they had a conscience. But no help from the authorities.
And urgent help is what millions across this region need. Now, more than ever.
Nick Beek. The Syrian civil defence group, the White Helmets, which has been searching for survivors in the rebel-held region of northwest Syria, has said it is now focused on the recovery of bodies rather than rescue. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, visited the city of Aleppo, which was devastated by the earthquakes. Dr. Tedros was accompanying medical supplies and said more would arrive on Sunday.
This is the first one, and then we will continue to support in providing the emergency supplies, which are important for trauma management to people who are affected by the earthquake.
The BBC's Quentin Somerville has been to the town of Harem in the rebel-held region of northwestern Syria. He said the difference between the rescue operation there and just over the border in Turkey was stark.
There's a bit of activity here, but nothing like you see in terms of activity on the other side, on the Turkish side of the border. People here have lost about 700 buildings, another 4,000 or so are unsafe. So they're living in tents. They're also telling us that in terms of foreign aid, they've received next to nothing. Some Spanish doctors made it to some of their hospitals, but nothing else. The contrast here with what's going on in Turkey is astonishing. Over on that side of the border, there's a constant sound of sirens, of heavy machinery, of people working. There's none of that here. While the international community isn't here, it's been left to small boys to remove the rubble from these broken buildings and to try and find bodies. They say that the time for looking for survivors has passed here. This is mainly a recovery mission. They're no longer rescuing people, and the reason they're no longer rescuing people is because the aid just didn't come quick enough.
Quentin Somerville. The Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said a United States military fighter jet acting on his orders has shot down a high-altitude airborne object over northwestern Canada. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Justin Trudeau said he ordered the shooting down of an unidentified object that had violated Canadian airspace. In a tweet, he confirmed that Canadian and US aircraft were scrambled and that an F-22 fighter jet successfully fired at the object. Mr. Trudeau said he'd spoken with President Biden and that Canadian forces would now recover and analyse the wreckage. A military mission is also continuing on sea ice off the Alaskan town of Dead Horse to recover debris from the other unspecified airborne object shot down on Friday. In a statement, the US Northern Command said that operation was moving slowly due to freezing temperatures, snow and limited daylight. Officials said they still had no further information to offer about the purpose and origin of the object, which was earlier said to be about the size of a small car.
Peter Bowes with that report. One of the main goals of President Zelensky's latest round of visits abroad was to solicit fighter jets for Ukraine's war with Russia. But while he's been given positive signals, there's been no firm commitment. Now, the Polish president, Andrzej Duda, has said providing fighter jets won't be easy and that it would be up to NATO to make any concrete decision about them. Speaking to the BBC, he also warned that by giving jets to Ukraine, Poland's own military defences would be weakened.
It is not enough just to send a few jets. And a problem that we're facing, at least in Poland, We have such jets, but they are fewer than 50. This poses a serious problem. If we donate even a small part of them anywhere, we would need many more of them.
Our correspondent Adam Easton told me why the request for fighter jets is different to tanks being sent to Ukraine.
Aircraft need so much more maintenance and trained service personnel to maintain them than tanks do. And Ukraine simply doesn't have the trained personnel to maintain modern Western fighters, and will probably need to get them from the West. Another significant difference is that planes can be used by Ukraine to strike targets deep inside Russia, something that tanks cannot do. And that worries people like the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, for example, who has said that by sending aircraft, NATO will be getting more and more directly involved in the war.
Yeah, is Poland frightened?
It certainly publicly is saying we only will do what NATO agrees to do. Poland is frightened about what might happen to it. It is certainly hawkish. A senior government official has told me that it wants as many countries as possible to push for planes to be sent. But it's what type of planes. As President Duda said in that clip, Poland will not be sending its modern American F-16s. It hasn't got enough of them, hasn't got anything to replace them with. But last year it wanted to send its older Soviet-era MiG fighters to Ukraine, and I could see that happening. Slovakia has offered to send its MiGs as well, and Ukraine already has MiG aircraft. The Air Force already uses them, so they know how to operate them, and they don't need the additional maintenance support that, you know, the modern Western fighters President Zelensky calling for.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. Pro-government rallies have been taking place in Iranian cities to mark the 44th anniversary of the revolution that overthrew the monarchy. They're happening amidst months of nationwide anti-government protests sparked by the death in custody of a young Iranian Kurdish woman. Human rights groups say the crackdown by the government has led to hundreds of deaths and thousands of arrests. Mary Louise Kelly is a host at US National Public Radio. She's on a rare reporting trip to Iran and spoke to my colleague James Kumarasamy from Tehran about how the anniversary was being marked.
We have just come from the main festivities, thousands upon thousands of people who have been walking in a rally toward Freedom Square in central Tehran. The kids have got face paint of the Iranian flag. There are a lot of people carrying signs, placards, either with photos of Khamenei, the supreme leader, or with down with USA, down with Israel. The people who have turned out to mark Revolution Day tend to be the ones who are loyal to this regime. Some people told us, look, I'm not here to support the government. I'm here because I support Iran. I support my country, and we need to stand together and show some national unity.
Just give us a flavor of the encounters you've had with Iranian people in the streets.
So we've talked to people in shops, in the bazaar. We've been in Tehran most of the time, but managed to make it to Isfahan, another city about 5 hours south of here. It's a big country. It's 85 million people. There's a big range of views, from very loyal to saying this regime needs to go. It is past time. I would rather die than live in this country under this government. You got a flavor of it last night when the government had sponsored this big fireworks show to kick things off. And we opened the windows in our hotel here to listen. And as soon as the fireworks started, chanting started. Couldn't tell where it was coming from, but apartment buildings all around us, voices calling out, and what they were calling was death to the dictator, death to Khamenei, freedom.
Very striking. What evidence have you found of that movement, other than those chants that you heard? What sort of evidence have you found of the way certain numbers of people in Iranian society are clearly very unhappy with the direction the country is taking?
On the surface, things do seem calm. The protests have quieted. The question is that because the government has crushed them? But the grievances that fueled those protests, have they actually gone away? Again, range of answers, but overwhelmingly, as we have spoken to people, many of them very frightened to speak to us, by the way, we're interviewing them and looking for cameras and don't want to be quoted by name. But they're saying, no, that the spirit of the protest is not gone. And it has gone so far this time. The young people in this country have stood up and energized people, and even people we spoke to today who turned out for the revolution events and are holding big posters of Khamenei, even they were saying, this country needs change. The economy is a mess. and things need to change. I spoke to one woman in Isfahan, and I asked her, the 44th anniversary of the revolution, do you think 44 years from now we will still be marking this? Do you think this regime will be around? And she said, no, there is this sense of freedom here now. And she said, I don't think the regime will last another 2 years. Now, that said, again, on the surface, things seem calm, and the government seems very firmly in control.
And you were able to speak to the foreign minister, weren't you? Tell us about that encounter and what you gleaned from it.
We spent a lot of time on what's happening here domestically. It was a very tense interview where we were pushing him. He told me people were free to speak freely in Iran. And I said, I'm not sure, because people seem really scared to speak to an American journalist. People point to cameras and say, they're watching us. And he said, this is not true. There are not many cameras in this country. Dozens of journalists have been arrested more since we have arrived in the country. We asked about that. We asked about executions. There have been 4 people executed for their role in protests. We asked about the internet. The government acknowledges it has deliberately slowed the internet because they say in a time of upheaval, they need to promote calm and stability. So very popular apps like Instagram have been banned. Students here, young people have told us they ban Instagram so that we can't tell the world what's happening here. And we put that question to the foreign minister, and we went around on that one for a little while as well.
Mary Louise Kelly of National Public Radio in Tehran. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
The general public wouldn't give a penny for his paintings and actually thought it was quite ugly.
What the Dutch really thought of the famous painter Vincent van Gogh when he was alive. There have been further large protests in France against President Macron's plans to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. He says these are essential to ensure the pension system is workable by the end of the decade. Mr. Macron's proposals would bring France closer into line with its European neighbours, most of which have retirement ages of 65 or higher. But polls suggest that 2/3 of people oppose the changes. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield is in Paris.
You join me just off Boulevard Voltaire in the eastern part of the city. The march is going behind me. It's from Place de la République to Place de la Nation, which is that way. So far, big turnout, no doubt about that. The CGT, which is the main, quite hardline union here, is talking about 500,000 people on the streets of Paris. We could take that with a massive pinch of salt, probably divide it by 500,000. But even so, it is a big turnout. And what the unions hope to do by having demonstrations today, a Saturday, was to get out people who don't normally demonstrate in the week. They don't want to go on strike because they don't want to lose a day's pay. The idea was that on a Saturday you'd get more families, more ordinary working people in the private sector would join in. And I think they're probably going to say that it's paid off because there are an awful lot of people out here and in other towns and cities joining this movement now against the plan to push back the age of retirement. So that's what is motivating this protest. Social justice, in a word, and of course a great anti-Macron feeling which unites everyone in this demonstration. For a large part of the population, he is quite simply a hate figure.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Tens of thousands of teachers have marched through the Portuguese capital, Lisbon, to protest against the socialist government's refusal to give more ground in talks on pay, working conditions and careers. Alison Roberts in Lisbon reports on the latest in a series of protests and strikes.
Schools United Will Never Be Defeated was among slogans at what was certainly one of the largest teachers' demonstrations ever seen in Portugal. Participants were angry at what they say are years of underfunding in schools, and more particularly the fact that 6.5 years already served by teachers aren't being counted for pay and pensions purposes. The protesters had other complaints too, mostly coming down to money.
It's very difficult. We stay in the same place for years and years. More classes, students, more paperwork, lots of paperwork.
The protests' overarching theme was respect for teachers and schools, organisers said. Talks with the government have made little progress so far.
Alison Roberts in Lisbon. To Pakistan, where a large crowd has stormed a police station, lynching a man who was being held there on suspicion of committing blasphemy. Reports say that his body was set alight. 2 senior officers have been suspended, and an investigation into what happened in Punjab province is underway. The BBC's Umair Nanajiana is in Lahore.
The police received a complaint that there was a man who was allegedly desecrating pages of Quran. He was in the police station when a large number of people gathered outside and they started chanting slogans and they demanded the police hand over the suspect to them. They stormed the police station. Some of them climbed the walls and they entered the police station. They forcefully released the suspect and tortured him and he died.
Blasphemy in Pakistan is a very serious charge. You can suffer the death penalty if you're convicted of it, but it's also abused, isn't it? Sometimes people allege blasphemy simply to settle a score of a completely unrelated matter.
Most of the times, this charge is misused. This law, in fact, is misused. Once the matter goes to the court and the police investigates it, and the facts are different from what I reported earlier. But this is, as you said, a very sensitive issue. If somebody is accused of blasphemy, his or her life is in danger immediately. So they'll have to get some protection from the police, from the authorities, or any other source that they can. The government has been trying to, you know, stop it, but they've not really been successfully able to stop the misuse of the law. They have come down very strictly in the past few incidents on the people who committed these lynchings and tortures. The courts have also awarded death penalties to those people.
Why do people get sucked into these crowds that commit such awful acts on stories that they know nothing about, particularly when this law is abused?
Because this honour of the Prophet and the honour of the Holy Book and the religion in general is very sensitive. And most of the people in the province of Punjab in particular, where these incidents mostly happen, are very, very sensitive around these things. And whenever somebody would, you know, accuse another person of blasphemy, he would normally get a large support.
The BBC's Umair Nana Jiana in Lahore. For more than six decades, Cuba has been subject to draconian US economic sanctions. They affect almost all aspects of daily life, from trade to tourism. The Cuban authorities blame the island's woes on the long-running embargo, but critics point the finger squarely at the communist-run economic model. Whatever the cause, record numbers of young people are attempting to get visas to leave the island. Will Grant sent this report from Havana.
At a stadium in Havana, a group of Cuba's best young baseball players are competing for a unique opportunity. A place on the first Cuban team to take part in the Little League World Series in Pennsylvania in August. Accomplished pitcher and first baseman, 12-year-old David Acosta is confident of making the cut. His eyes light up when he talks of playing competitive baseball in the United States. The New York Yankees always, he says with a smile when asked where he sees himself one day. But such dreams are even harder for Cuban children. David has only known life under US sanctions and communist rule. Sport is just one area affected by the embargo. In 2018, the United Nations estimated it had cost the island's economy some $130 billion over the past six decades.
The Cuban government still has a lot of agency when it comes to transforming the reality of the country.
Ricardo Torres is a Cuban economist who is currently a research fellow at the American University in Washington, D.C. He says the Cuban government's insistence that the island's economic woes are almost solely the result of the embargo only tells half the story.
It's simple and complex at the same time. It's simple in terms of accepting the fact that the current system, it's a failure, and it will never deliver what the Cuban people need. Then engaging in a systematic, serious, strategic reform. Cuba needs it.
Every year in late January, thousands of students stream down the steps of the University of Havana in a late-night march, carrying torches in homage to the island's independence hero, José Martí. Ask the students their thoughts on the state of the island's crumbling economy, and they'll faithfully echo a well-drilled script. The US economic embargo is to blame, they'll inevitably say. But catch up with Havana's young people away from the ears of the authorities, in the streets, and I found them more candid than ever about the direction Cuba is headed. I'd move to the US if I had the chance, drama student Lionel says. I've experienced life here and it's time to try something else. Others were equally frank.
Everyone is suffering, but young people are hurting twice as much because we think differently from the government. We sit among the people queuing for basic things. Our parents' salaries can't afford the food prices. This needs to change.
It's no secret that there are economic problems in Cuba, but I don't accept the correlation with the embargo. It's been in place for many years.
Change is needed, not in the long term, but in the short term. This crisis is causing so much immigration right now.
As relations between the Biden administration and the Cuban government have improved slightly, people are now beginning to get appointments for their visa applications. There's a long queue outside the US Embassy in Havana. The truth is, of the thousands who pass through each month, only a very small handful will actually make it to the United States.
Will Grant in Havana. A senior MP in South Africa has said that one of the country's most popular rappers was the victim of a professional hit. Beauty Dlulane, who chairs a parliamentary committee on arts and culture, was speaking after Kiernan Forbes, better known as AKA, was shot dead on Friday in Durban. She called on the authorities to protect South Africans from what she said was a new scourge of contract and revenge killings targeting performing artists and DJs. Last November, a house music star was killed with his bodyguard in a drive-by shooting in Johannesburg, from where Nomsa Maseko sent this report.
The killing of South African rapper and music producer Kiernan Forbes, popularly known as AKA, has sent shockwaves and caused heartbreak, even in a country with one of the highest murder rates in the world. All the dreams and fantasies that come together, I'll be shining like a diamond, that's forever. AKA was shot along with his longtime friend Debelo Motswane, known as Tibbs, on Durban's Florida Road, one of the city's most vibrant spots. Police spokesperson Robert Nechiwunda has told the BBC that the rapper and his associate were walking to their car when they were approached by two men who shot them at close range. The assailants fled the scene on foot. Police have said they don't want to speculate on whether this was an assassination by paid hitmen, but said that possibility cannot be ruled out. It's understood the 35-year-old was making his way to a nightclub for a performance as part of his birthday celebrations when he was shot. Think back to my old days.
All I wanted was a gold chain. Nomsa Maseko in Johannesburg. The bright burst of sunflowers, the purple irises, starry nights and self-portraits. Millions of people visit the Van Gogh Museum in the Netherlands to see those famous paintings. The gallery has its origins in a family collection. As the museum marks its 50th anniversary this year, it's staging an exhibition called Vincent, Portrait of Family History. Jana Haling is chair of the Vincent van Gogh Foundation in Amsterdam and is related to the artist. She spoke to Martha Carney.
I am the great-great-granddaughter of Theo, the brother of Vincent, and he had one son, and that's my great-grandfather. And Vincent painted the most world-famous birthday gift because he painted the almond blossom, especially for the birth of my great-grandfather. That's a really beautiful story. And the painting actually, through generations, hang in several homes and ended up in a bedroom where, amongst others, other family members, my grandfather had pillow fights with his brothers and sister. And they would tell me that it's actually a miracle that the painting survived and ended up in one piece in the Van Gogh Museum.
It's amazing that it did survive all those pillow fights. But It's so interesting that the kernel of this collection did come from the family, because I think people may not remember, but Van Gogh, you know, when he died, his art was still regarded as very avant-garde, wasn't it? It wasn't collectible at that stage.
Yes, of course, his brother Theo was an art dealer, and there was a very small group of people that already during Vincent's life recognized his talent as an artist, but the general public wouldn't give a penny for his paintings and actually thought it was quite ugly. And then after that, Theo died. 6 months after Vincent. And then his wife, Jo van Gogh-Bonger, she was 28 and she was a widow and she had a small baby boy and this huge collection of paintings. And she decided to realize Vincent and Theo's dream of really let the world know how important Vincent's work was.
Jana Haling speaking to Martha Carney. And if you happen to be passing through, that exhibition continues at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam until the 10th of April. Experts in Britain are trying to track down lost pieces of fashion history from across the world. The Museum of London is appealing for help to try to find the clothes for an exhibition later this year. Richard Hamilton reports.
There are many Jewish communities in London, and between 1881 and the start of the First World War, more than 60% of Jewish immigrants who came to the city worked in the dress and textile trade. Fashion City, How Jewish Londoners Shaped Global Style, is the title of this exhibition, and the Museum of London wants to highlight the role of Jewish designers in dressing celebrities and influencing cultural trends. Lucy Whitmore is the curator.
We're looking for the pieces by designers like Mr. Fish, Otto Lucas and Cecil G, and worn by rock stars, pop stars and royalty. We're asking people to help. To give you an example, there's an amazing dress made by a designer, Mr. Fish. He was famous in the kind of late 60s, early 70s for doing innovative kind of spins on classic menswear and for putting men in dresses and skirts and caftans. David Bowie famously wore a Mr. Fish dress on the cover of his album, The Man Who Sold the World. We don't know where that dress is, so that is the dream piece that we would love to know where it is. And, you know, perhaps it's in a private collection, perhaps it's in a small museum. We've just not been able to track it down.
Another iconic piece designed by Mr. Fish is a white robe worn by the heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali before his famous fight against George Foreman in 1974 in Kinshasa in Zaire, known as the Rumble in the Jungle.
This may be a historic event. Muhammad Ali coming into the boxing ring for the last time.
So if anyone has it lying in their cupboard or wardrobe, they should get in touch. The six-month exhibition starts at the Museum of London Docklands on the 13th of October.
Not wearing a dress today, anyway. That's Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nikki Brough and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritz, and until next time, goodbye.